We're doing the Netivot Shalom on Parshat Balak, Vayeshev Yisrael Bashitim. Our topic is the sin of Israel in the place called Shittim. Israel settled down in this place called Shittim. Vayachel Ha'am Liznot El Benot Moav. The nation started being promiscuous with the daughters of Moav. Vayitzamed Yisrael Leval Peor. Israel clung to the pagan idol Baal Peor. Vayicharaf Hashem b'Yisrael, God's anger kindled against Israel. Hinei hayu kan bet chataim. If you look at the parasha, you see there were two sins. Hachet shel Baal Peor, v'achet shel benot Moav. The sin of the pagan idol Baal Peor, and the sin of the daughters of Moav. And if you look closely at the verse, it seems that the plague was as a response to the sin of Baal Peor. If you look closely, in next week's parasha, it says the name of the man who was killed on the day of the plague of Baal Peor. So it's called the plague over the sin of Peor. And we see when Moshe commands the justices to do justice, he says, "Hirgu ish anashav anitzmadim leval peor." Each of you are responsible to judge the person who clung, the people who clung to Baal Peor. Mashma sheze haya ikar achet. The verses certainly seem to indicate that the prime sin over here was Baal Peor. But what happens at the end of the parasha, right? So the Israelites are sinning, and then Moshe tells the judges to judge, and along comes the leader of which tribe? Zimri ben Salu, Nesi Beit Av La Shimoni, the head of the tribe of Shimon, and he grabs the top Midianite girl, the beauty of beauties, the Talmud says. She was so beautiful. You guys listening closely? It says she was so beautiful. She was as wide as from this window to that parking lot. That's how gorgeous she was. She said, that's the Talmud's way of saying she was a real beauty. In their days, they admired women who were corpulent. So if you want to say she's really beautiful, she was the size of 18 women. That's a gorgeous woman. Okay, so the Talmud says she was the beauty of beauties who was sent out to seduce Moshe. And Zimri grabs her and says, he's a leader, I'm a leader just like him. It's enough that you go with me. And he brings her in front of Moshe and says, she's a Midianite girl just like your wife. You married a Midianite girl. Who gave you permission? If you could do it, I could do it. And then he takes her to a public tent, and Pinchas comes over. And how's he going to get in? So Pinchas leans on a staff, and inside the staff he has hidden the blade that can go in the staff. And the tribe of Shimon is surrounding their leader, and Pinchas says, hey, I want a piece of action too. So they look at Pinchas and they say, oh, he wants to join in what we're all doing. So he leans on his staff and he hobbles in, and then he attaches the blade and he runs up to their tent and he sticks in the spear, and it pierces both of them and he kills both of them. And he picks up the blade, and he must have been some warrior. He holds them too. He picks up the spear and he holds both of them up. They've come, his spear says, thrust them through the tent, and he holds them both up and everyone sees them like a banner. I guess this wasn't for kids. Kids don't, you know, not to watch. The two are intimately entwined, hanging on his spear, and he's killed them both. So that's what happens at the end of this week's parasha. And then next week's parasha is Parshas Pinchas. But in this week's parasha is the sin. Now, when you look, so the plague was against Baal Peor. The requirement to judge was about Baal Peor. But when Pinchas risked his life, he risked his life over the promiscuity of the Moabites girls. Pinchas risked his life for the sin with the Moabite girls. It's tzarich biur, so we have to clarify. Why is it that Pinchas risks his life over that sin with the girls of Moab? Why didn't he stand up for the prime sin where they were serving a foreign god? They were serving Baal Peor. And if we do a simple halachic calculation, so then the prohibition of doing idol worship is more severe than the prohibition of going with a non-Jewish girl, right? You have to give up your life, right, rather than do idol worship. You don't have to give up your life rather than go with a non-Jewish girl. He basically says what I just said, just with a little bit more halachic detail. So that's question number one. Why is it that Pinchas risks his life for the znos, the promiscuity, and not for the paganism? Number two, we also have to understand, why is it that on this occasion it's Pinchas who steps up to the plate? He's the one that fixes the situation. It's not Moshe. If you look at the 40 years we were in the desert, it was always Moshe who was the great rescuer in every situation. So why over here does it have to be Pinchas who saves the day? So that's question number two. Yes? You wanted to say something?
I have a question.
Oh, okay, I have many, yeah?
If the Moabites... Originally I was going to ask, when you said the beauty of beauties, I was going to say, how could that be? Because aren't they all like inbred mutants because of Lot and the daughter? Then you clarified that she was really large. And then my next question with regards to that, how is it that Pinchas' staff was able to hold them?
That's part of the miracle here. You're right. Must have had a very big staff. You're right. Right? Pinchas must have been a pretty big guy. He was chief general. Not one of these wimpy fellows. Pinchas must have been a muscle man, yeah.
I thought that Balfior was the idol that the Israelites pretended to worship in order to have access to the
very
and
nice.
That's why it was the two together?
Let's see. Okay. He will address that. That's a very good point. And now he's going to touch on some very key concepts in Avodas Hashem. It's really picked a good one, yeah.
I'm really baffled by this whole the idea that, okay, in times of this famine, there is an idea that she's heavier set or something, that is just eating, and that's she's captive because she's eating, because she's healthy, but as a platonic ideal of femininity or something, that seems kind of ridiculous.
Why? How do you define beauty? There are two types of beauty. There's beauty that's symmetry, that's yefei toar, and then there's beauty that the eye enjoys looking at, and that's yefei mar'eh. Now, symmetry is a different question, but beauty that the eye enjoys looking at, well, that's very much affected by society. If society trains you from the time you're 2 years old, that's fat, and I have to lose weight, and I'm really overweight, and I really got to take off this poncho, so then your perspective is always that's disgusting. But if you would grow up from day one, you were told that part of being feminine is that's the way a woman should look, so that can be admired. I think the beauty is very defined by society. The Chinese worship small feet. We don't begin to understand what's so cute about a small foot. Okay, they break their girls' feet. They put them into molded shoes because she'd have a flat foot, a small foot. That's beautiful. And in Egypt, they used to worship girls that had long earlobes. Throughout Africa, they still do it. The girls wear weights on their earlobes, and that's a beauty. A girl that has an earlobe down to her shoulder, ooh, wow, that's gorgeous. Okay, go figure.
There must be some kind of objective standard if God created certain women. They're all Chava was the most beautiful one, and heading down. They must have had some kind of.
Noah gives you new perspective on what it means. Chava was so beautiful. Rachav was so beautiful. Now you understand why Rachav was called Rachav, so wide. Think about it. In their days, that's what they considered beautiful. We're the first, this is the first period in world history, as far as I know, that worships skinniness, saying it's only this century. Up until this century, throughout world history, people thought beautiful was corpulent.
So
go look at all the medieval art.
A few extra pounds?
No, much more than a few extra pounds. Yeah.
Look at Rubens. I mean, all the artists who showed years ago, all of them in their paintings, were all heavy set.
Yeah, come on.
Imagine, eh?
The sumo wrestlers are the hottest guys, right?
Finally,
the sumo wrestlers.
What?
What,
this isn't good to go right?
I have no idea. In all honesty, I don't know if... in the Orient, they really think that the sumo wrestlers are beautiful. I don't know. But when I was a kid, part of our elementary school reading was to read from the Orient. And I still remember as a kid, there was a story about a wrestler that went to train and fell in love with this huge, huge girl, a sumo wrestler who saw a female sumo. And he keeps, as a kid, this was part of our elementary school reading. So, I don't know. I don't know if it was just like, you know, an American elementary school reading, or it was based on a real story. I don't know. So at any rate, I think much of beauty is defined by society.
We don't think that there's an objective standard to like.
Is there an objective side? I said there's the symmetry, and that's objective, but everything else, I don't think so. You know, in some societies, blonde is beautiful. In other societies, blonde is sickly. Who wants a blonde? You want someone with black, jet black. That's beautiful.
In
other societies,
one thing can be beautiful, one thing can be hideous.
Right. Right. I'm saying, look, today you bring a woman that was considered a beauty, I don't think people would look at her. They wouldn't feel comfortable standing on the train next to her. Right? A woman, I'm saying this Cosby, if she was as broad as Chazal say, you know, people would be looking at her and saying she belongs in the circus. You know, but in those days, she was a princess. She was the world's beauty.
So what does that say have to do with people like Sarah or whoever else is considered a Vashti?
Right? I don't know of a place that it says it explicitly, but I always assumed that Sarah was very heavy set and Chava was very heavy set and Vashti was very heavy set.
Does Chazal say?
I don't remember it saying. I don't remember that.
You know, maybe that's like the association with physicality and like earthiness and like, like literally the heavy set as part of the physical nature of like beauty.
I don't know. The Chazal have a lot of descriptions about that. Chazal tell us that Esther was not heavy set, but Chazal also say that Esther was very beautiful. Was not beautiful, I'm sorry. Esther was not beautiful, and Esther, it seems, was sickly. You know, she was like a scrawny little thing, something that today they'd say was gorgeous, but in the days of Ahasuerus, it was a miracle that he thought she was beautiful. They say from many other aspects she wasn't beautiful. I don't know. Okay, so back to Ntivot Shalom. We have to understand why is it specifically Pinchas? If Moshe was always the one who saved the day, why did it have to be Pinchas over here? So, to clarify this, two foundations in the service of Hashem is Emunah and Kedusha. And they are the two pillars that are truth. When a Jew elevates himself in these two fronts, be it emunah, his, I don't want to say faith, because that's an inaccurate translation, his emunah, his ideological connection, his spiritual connection to Hashem, and kedusha, his holiness, so then he can uplift himself in all of Torah and mitzvot. And when one hurts either one of those two, his emunah or his kedusha, we'll say faith even though that's inaccurate, and his holiness, then that affects everything. That's like touching the pillars the house is built on. When it comes to emunah, faith, the strength of emunah runs in a Jew's veins. It's implanted in his blood. As God said to Moshe, Moshe says, why will the Jews believe? I'm going to come and tell them you sent me, and they'll say, no, God didn't. And God says to Moshe, you don't understand my people. They are believers, the sons of believers. Shekoach ze yesh lanu od me'Avraham Avinu. We have this strength dating back to Avraham Avinu, sheishrisho lechol adorot. Avraham Avinu implanted it in the Jewish people for all generations to come. I think that this idea that he's mentioning here has many, many outgrowths. I mean, this is a core idea that branches out to many topics. It's something worth remembering. This idea that a Jew's response and a non-Jew's response to the same scenario is going to be different. That there's something that runs in our blood that's called emunah, and it's not going to change. V'rabotenu HaKadoshim Amru, and our holy teachers said, Ki af b'shah sheyudi no margish te'emunah, even at a time when a Jew doesn't feel that emunah, tzarich lehamin ki hu ma'amin. You have to believe that he believes. There are moments when he doesn't feel like he believes. Guys, this thought alone deserves a lot of thought. You have minutes when you don't think you're believing. And even then, you have to believe that you're believing.
What do you mean?
I said, think about it.
When I don't... Moments of doubt, you have to believe that you believe.
Okay, maybe that's better, Senya.
So if you catch yourself doubting, you have to believe that really you believe, and the doubt is just a distraction from your belief.
Oh, ורק שאבים מחסים את אור האמונה. There are clouds that are covering the light of emunah. אבל בפנימיות נפשו, but if you check deep down in his soul, הוא מאמין. He is still a believer. כיוון שאמונה טבועה בדמו של יהודי. Because emunah is in the blood of a Jew. I had a very strange story in the Machon a few years ago. We had a student who was probably one of the top students that I remember ever walking through the doors of the Machon. Very diligent, studied nonstop, studied and performed mitzvot, and was always on time for davening. And one day he walks into the office and said, Rabbi, you know, it's been 2-3 years I've been doing all of this, and I don't believe a word of it. So I said, that's very interesting. You know, you put on a really good show. He said, yeah, I know I'm putting on a really good show, but I don't believe any of it. So we started having a discussion, which led to another discussion, And he basically said, you know, in all my tefillot, I never connected once. I always felt like I was standing in front of a wall. Every mitzvah I did, I never felt a stitch of holiness. I always felt like I was just doing some rote act. I analyzed it logically. I decided it was right. But you ask me if I ever have emunah, I don't know what the word means. And we worked together. I set up a whole series for him, working out a lot of the logical claims behind Torah and observancy and tradition and orthodoxy. And I kept telling him, I don't believe you. I don't believe that you don't feel anything. I don't believe that you never had a tefillah where you felt it was accepted or you had anything. But you know, after a year of having this discussion, so logically I told him I don't believe him, but emotionally I believed him completely. And at some point I said to him, you know, you're going off to do your thing. Maybe it's a good thing. You'll have a break. Maybe you've spent too much time analyzing this. And maybe you'll have a break. You'll come back to it. You'll see things differently. And then he told me, being that logically I understand this is right, so I'm doing it, but I don't connect on any other level. Logically, fine, I'm doing it. Zero connection. And I kept saying, I don't believe it. But again, I don't believe it became very weak after a year. It's like, okay, you know... Okay? The guy leaves the machon. 3 months later, 4 months later, I get an email from him. I'm so busy. I'm sorry I haven't written. I don't have a head for anything. We'll talk in another month or two. Fine. 2 months later, he shows up. He wants to get married. He met the girl of his dreams. So I say, hold your horses, buddy. Wait a second. You're ready to get married. You don't feel anything. What kind of religion are you going to have in your house? Logically, this is what you do. Daven and chuckle and mean it, but you'll feel like you're standing in front of a wall. So he looks at me incredulously and says, Rabbi, you're still there in front of that wall. Come on. No, of course you're talking to God and he's listening. I said, what do you mean? For 3 years you kept telling me nothing. There's nothing there. He said, okay, but there is something there. Okay. No. I asked him when the change occurred. I asked him, I don't remember his answer accurately, but it wasn't the woman in his life. No. So the Netivot Shalom says there are moments when what you see is darkness. You don't see that spark. You don't see that connection. You don't see any emunah. Right now what you see is nothing, a chasm, a vacuum. There's no meaning, there's no emunah. All life has to offer is its hardships and there's no connection. And at those moments, and this is a concept that he repeats throughout his work in different veins, he says, in those moments you have to believe that you believe. I'll quote an application that he says in another place. He says, sometimes a person can be in such a dark place that they have a hard time believing that God listens to a word they say. And they have a hard time believing that they're ever going to get out of where they are, because all they see is what they've done wrong and what they see as all their troubles. And at moments like that, a person has to cling to the concept that there's still a spark in me called Neshama Shenatata Bi. Hashem did put that soul in me. And that soul means that he has faith in me and he's still waiting. I'm still ticking. As bad as things are, I'm here. I'm thinking these thoughts. I can move. I can do something. So sometimes there's nothing else left to hang on to, says the Netivot Shalom. So hold on to that. Sometimes that's the spark. Over here, he's saying a similar idea. He's saying, even when you have moments that you don't feel like you're a believer. It's like, yeah, I've been doing everything. And I think this is a very potent point that comes up during the break. Guys sometimes go and visit their families. And you're sitting there and they're all going on Saturday night to the movies. And you stick your guns and you say, no, this is Shabbos, guys. You're invited. I'll make kiddush. You'll see what Shabbos is all about. And they say, enjoy the kiddush, but there's a great movie out, and you want, we'll tell you. If you want, we'll film it for you with our camera. We'll bring it home. You'll be able to watch it during your Shabbos meal, And you're like, guys, let me show you. There's a song. There's special bread. It's called Challah. I brought it. And they say, thanks. Enjoy. And then they say, wait a second. Why don't you finish your meal? We'll catch the next showing. You don't have to get in the car. We'll drive. You walk. We'll meet you there. We'll pay. You'll watch. Is there any prohibition on Shabbos and watching a movie? Come on. Come enjoy the movie. We'll bring your kosher popcorn from home. And you stand there and you say, no. Guys, this isn't what Shabbos is supposed to be like. I'm not going. You guys are invited to join me, but I'm not going out there to the movie. And you stick your guns. You stick to your guns. You don't move. And they all go. And then you're left to the quiet house. And you stick to your guns, you say your kiddush, you sing your songs, but you're sitting there eating alone. And you can't help but look out the window as the car goes out and remember that there were times that you were in that car and it was fun. You can't deny it was fun. You see your brother munching on those, what do they call those bacon bars?
Beef jerky.
The beef jerky, right. And you know exactly what it tastes like. And you're saying, no, I'm with my tuna fish. Oh, you tuna fish. And he goes, Mike, you want a bite? And you're going like, no, it's not kosher. So you stick to your guns, but suddenly your guns seem a little smaller. And they're going off and you're staying there having your shamus meal, your tuna fish and your challahs, singing your songs in this house. And the phone rings and the answering machine comes on and it's your brother. Mike, did you change your mind? We'll come back and pick you up. And you're thinking, I can't answer that phone. Mike, come on. If you change your mind, we'll come. You're thinking, I can't answer that phone. Okay, you sit there, you smile to yourself, you feel bad for them, or you try to feel bad for them, and you start feeling bad for yourself. And then the Shabbos progresses, and they come back, and they're talking, and you're not a part of it. And the next morning, you go out to daven, they're all sleeping in late, they're going to get up and watch the cartoons. You used to do that. And suddenly, everything you did starts looking different. And you look back and you say, do I even want to get back on that plane? Maybe I've become a fanatic. Maybe everything there just isn't real. Oh no, it's real. But this feels very real. And it's fun. And I know what it is. And I grew up with it. And it's not so bad. And maybe I could get a compromise. People, when they go off on the break, sometimes never come back to where they were. Meaning they come back, but suddenly everything seems different. They look at everything differently. It's like, yeah, this is nice, but the cars in America are bigger, and I could get a Slurpee at 7-Eleven that's this big for 99 cents. Come on, I can't even get a Slurpee or forget 99 cents. And Dunkin' Donuts, when are they going to open a normal branch here? You come back, and suddenly everything looks different. And then a person can suddenly ask himself, wait, am I connected? Was it for real? Everything that happened beforehand, maybe I was under some kind of spell. There are moments, and it's normal, there are moments that a Jew does not feel like he is a believer. Everything seems fake. And at those moments, says Netivot Shalom, a person has to believe that he does believe. A person has to be able to say, no, I know it was right. It doesn't feel right now. No. Tell you a secret. Big rabbis had this too. There are stories of rebbes in Hasidut whose Hasidim caught them smoking on Shabbos. Yeah. Big people have their fools. The biographies don't like telling you that. But even big people have their moments, and their moments can last not only a day, but a week or a month or a year. People have their downs, and that's part of growth. And a person has to know these tools that when he's down, he can tell himself, no, I believe that I do believe. I don't sense it right now. But if you ask me who I am deep down inside, that's who I am. Right now, it's a lot of clouds covering all that. But that's who I am. Yeah.
Rebbe's that we read?
Huh? Yes?
Like they, you know, he smoked on Shabbat and we have a sefer on an hour and
part. Yeah, why does that take away? Let me tell you, there's a book you read by someone who, for all intents and purposes, raped. And everyone reads his book. He lived 2,000 years ago. And he did tshuva, and it was approved by a prophet. But you know what? When a king takes a girl who's 7 years old, I think that's rape. And she was a married woman at the moment. So technically, halachically, she had a divorce from her husband. Right. But
did you say that Bathsheba was 7?
The Gemara says she was 7. And if you look at the psukim closely, you'll see the math the Gemara does to figure it out. Changes the picture a little bit, Yaakov, right? So the fact that someone had it down doesn't mean they can't make it back up. You know, in our history, big people had big downs. And we don't hold it against it. You know, Reish Lakish in the Gemara, he was a big Talmud Chacham, became a chief bandit, and then he did tshuva. But he had his period where he was a top thief. He was the head of a gang of thieves and murderers and rapists, according to some interpretations of that line.
What does that mean for like stuff that we do?
That means that there's potential to come back. That means that a person should never think that it's all over. A person should never look at himself and say, after what I did, there's no coming back.
Or this isn't for me.
Or this isn't for me, right? Right? Yeah. You see that?
I'm just thinking like, you know, okay, I've done sins or whatever, but, you know, I never raped a 7-year-old. Like, this is
good
like,
for you.
Like, wow, you know.
Okay.
Like, so what's my level of, like, you know, okay, so I didn't, maybe if I sunk lower that I would have realized how horrible what I actually did was, and then I would do more better tshuva.
Greater people have greater desires and greater tests, and when they do greater tshuva, they get to greater places.
I have a friend who was here with me, went to Chutz Laaretz, came back, and then he like went off the deep end. He spent Shabbat in South Tel Aviv, and he was asking me to come with him.
Mm. Okay, it's very hard, but one of the tools that the Tivot Shalom just taught us is that concept that even when I can't tap into it, I should recognize it's there. That spark is still a part of me. It's always going to be a part of me. Yes.
You know, we would call, like, you know, being with a 7-year-old like a perversion.
Well, she was married, so then you see that in those days that was considered marriageable. The Talmud says, that's one of the Talmud's points, that in those days the girls matured younger. Now, if you think about it, her grandfather died at 30, her grandfather. So if people were living till 30, they did get married much younger and they had to mature much younger. And they also write, that's the Gemara's point. The Gemara wants to prove over there that the girls in earlier generations could have kids at a younger age.
Now.
Right? That the girls at 7-year-old could father a girl. Don't father a kid. Don't forget, she got pregnant. No 7-year-old today could get pregnant, under normal circumstances. She got pregnant and had the child. And a few months later, had another child. So she was super fertile at that point.
I think part of the issue when you go back to Chutz Laaretz, or in his case, with his friend in Tel Aviv, is you see people doing what you used to do. And now you're in a position of restraining yourself and not doing the things that you used to do. And you're not always thrilled with it. And then you see them having lots of fun with what they're doing. The lightning bolts aren't zapping them down. They're getting the $100,000 a year job. They're doing fine. So if I'm doing the right thing and I'm not seeing anything coming from it, and they're doing the wrong thing, but they're having all the prizes come their way, then why am I restraining myself if there's no system of right and wrong and toward money and whatever? That's the biggest thing.
I think that's a part of it. That's a part of it. There's also the habit. And it's so easy to fall back into what we're used to, especially when we go back to home territory, all our old friends. And it feels natural.
And I'm a good person, so what would be the worst thing if I went back to my old ways? I'm not killing, I'm not raping, I'm not pillaging. So, what's the deal?
Right?
I'm not any friends in that old life. But I'm not any friends in that old life. So.
Yes.
So, wait, how long
was it from the time of King David to the time of, like, the
Mishnah? Let's see. 300, 400, 900, approximately 900 years. So 900 years, we went from girls being totally fertile and, at like, younger than 7 probably, to 18 is the ideal age for a man to get married. Think that they would be like maturing and that like he was a grandfather at 30, that's like, so it would be about maturing around the same age, so maybe like a year or two.
Right, in the days of Talmud it wasn't uncommon, and even today 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds could get pregnant. I mean, there's a range. 12 is like an average. Today it's different because girls are anorexic, so that prevents their period from coming for much later. Saying because girls keep themselves so skinny, so that's why they don't have a period for a much longer time. That's a common cause today. I'm saying, but girls who eat healthy and in societies where they eat healthy and they don't worship skinniness, so then it's very common that a girl is fertile younger. Coming back,
I just find the whole concept of the marriage, spiritual age is
Who said marriageable age is 18 for a girl?
What's marriageable age for a girl?
Once she's intelligent enough to know who she wants to marry. Intelligent enough, mature enough, that she knows what she wants in life. So for some girls that'll be 35, and for other girls that'll be 25, and for the average girl that'll be somewhere around 18, 19. And then you have exceptional girls who at 15 know what they want in life. But they're the exception in our day and age.
In ours, 150, 200 years ago, they were married when they were 13, 14.
Sure. Then they knew what they wanted in life. But life was simpler. Going back to the Netivot Shalom. V'chol hasfekot v'irurim shenoflim chatz v'shalom etzel Yehudi. And all the doubts and all the different contemplations that a person thinks and wishes he didn't think, and a person has all these thoughts that float around in the back of his head. You want to know what the root of it all says, then Tivot Shalom. It's all rooted back in holiness, where a person blemishes, where a person wounds his potential holiness. That's the when a person wounds his capacity to retain his holiness, and he emits his seed unnecessarily, and that's rooted with his thought. The whole idea of a person emitting his seed stems in Tanakh with the word yada, to know. Because we view it as an extension of one's thought. And when a person's mind has been blemished because he's allowed his mind to wander, that's where the blemish in his emunah comes in. And you could see it alluded to when God speaks to the serpent in the Garden of Eden, and the Medrash says that the Nachash represents the head, the chief angel in charge of the other side. Hu yishuf charosh v'ata teshufenu akev. It says he will trample you on the head, and you will try to catch him from the heel, right? The man tries to hit the snake on the head, and the snake tries to bite him at the heel. Hu yishuf charosh b'inyanei rosh. He will beat you with regards to rosh, the head. Inyanei emunah v'inyanei deot shu b'moach. That's the idea of emunah. That's the idea of, what do I believe in? That stems here. God tells the snake, you should know he's going to win you in that. Because I've implanted it in a Jew's psyche, in a Jew's being, that emunah is a part of him. But you should know that you could catch him. Where do you overpower him? With regards to the heel, that's the concept of kedusha, holiness. As we are taught, that the idea of akev, the heel, represents the conclusion of the body, which is the idea of holiness. As though you have the basis, and then you have the next step, which is holiness. And the next step begins where the body concludes, which is at the heel. You're, you know, from head to bottom. And so the idea of holiness begins, so to speak, with the heel. And God was telling the snake, you try to seduce him through there, that's going to be the constant battle. When a person starts with emunah, talk to a person when there are no girls in the room. Ask the person, what do you believe in? If you could take your mind off of the desire for promiscuity, it's very clear what we believe in. And then you ask a person, okay, well, if that's what you believe, then how should you behave? So a person says, of course I should be holy. But then a person walks out to the street, and he's attracted by all kinds of things. And he doesn't want to behave anything like he said in the classroom. He wants to behave the exact opposite. And then the desire to behave that way works its way back and challenges everything he believes. So there's the struggle. What begins with the head ends with the heel. That's the idea of holiness. And God tells the snake, you'll attack him through there. And then, just like the poison of the snake, it could go its way back up to the head. So that's a concept in Kabbalah. In all honesty, I don't either understand it. But there is this concept that holiness is alluded to with the idea of the heel being the conclusion of the body, and at when you conclude building the physical, that's when you start going to the next level of holiness. Whatever that means. I don't know how to explain it better than that. Yes?
You said earlier that, you know, think that for all intents and purposes, being with a seven-year-old is basically rape. So, it sounds like you don't buy the idea that, you know, a seven-year-old is really the equivalent of a 18-year-old girl, even if she, oh, yeah, I would love to be with this guy or whatever, that she thinks that she's a intelligent or mature enough to be married either. This seems like there's like an objective difference. The 7-year-old is not an 18-year-old, is not a 35-year-old, no matter how you cut it. One is just simply more objectively mature and ostensibly developed than the other, and one is more in the range of child. Even if she can have a period and get pregnant or whatever, this is not the... This really shouldn't be appropriate, or it's appropriate on like some kind of weird technicality. Like, you know, she can get pregnant, so therefore she... And if she has like reasonable intelligence or something, she just doesn't have the power of free will. But the
rape has nothing to do with age. Rape has nothing to do with age. She's a married woman. It's against her will. It's rape. Doesn't matter what how old she is.
I'll tell you, this.
We were literally saying that this was like he forced her.
That's rape. And, but the age doesn't matter. Rape is rape whether she's 7, 15, or 18. She was married.
She wasn't married.
On a technicality, later on, it turned out she wasn't married. Right?
I assume that this was consensual. That he's the king of Israel, you know? Like, so,
right. That's why we don't view it as consensual.
What's she doing tshuva for?
Where does it say she has to do tshuva? It says she did tshuva?
I asked about this concept of how she merited to have Shlomo after doing something ridiculously disgusting to her pseudo ex-husband, whatever, the whole thing. And I was told that she did tremendous tshuva, and that's even talked about in the Talmud, that the process that they went through and the tshuva that they did. So I was under the assumption that she did tshuva, and the reason she had to do tshuva because it was consensual. Yeah, it felt
so.